You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington, with guest Ken Bell. Tonight's episode, Earth's Mightiest Doggies. Good evening, Ken. How's it going?
Hey, good. How's it going, guys?
It's been a long week, but a fun one.
It's been good here, too. The Avengers came out. That was exciting.
Yes.
Yeehaw.
Woohoo. So I wound up seeing the midnight showing of the Avengers on Friday night in glorious two-dimension.
Ah.
Ditto.
Did anyone see it in 3D or in IMAX?
I did. I saw it in IMAX 3D.
Ooh, country and Western.
There's two types of IMAX. I saw it in the fake IMAX.
Oh, you mean like mini IMAX. IMAX with small letters. Yeah, I know that IMAX. That sucks.
Which is fine, though. It's. I mean, you know, the other one sometimes, if you're not all the way in the back row, kind of stinks anyway. You know, it's so big.
That's true.
It depends on which lowercase IMAX you're at, too.
My local IMAX is roughly double the screen size of my television at home, so I don't go there.
Really? Oh, no, this is pretty big.
That's cool. Big.
And it's got a terrific sound system. You can tell the difference between the regular movie theaters.
The 2D screens aren't bad. It's just that I expect a certain level of quality in IMAX, and you don't get that where my local is. So I could make a schlep to a better one. I'm just lazy.
I wouldn't want to see it any other way now. The IMAX 3D by my house has really turned me around on the 3D thing. They're starting to get better and better at it, and I'm starting to enjoy it more. You know, it's a nice experience. Just feels great. It was a great movie. What do you guys think?
Oh, so much fun. Oh, my goodness.
It was so good. Yeah.
So good. So if you haven't seen it, go out and see it. We'll probably wind up spoiling certain things, but we'll try not to be incredibly blatant, I suppose.
That said, spoilers.
Spoilers. Yes.
Warning, spoilers.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
DEFCON spoiler alert 5. Yeah, it wound up doing some ridiculous amount of money in pre-sales. I was talking with Kanan about it earlier in the week, and he said it was doing $1 billion with a B in worldwide pre-sales.
Wow, I don't know about that. I do know that it did $200.3 million for the weekend.
Yeah.
Biggest opening ever.
Totally crazy. And it's for a comic book film as well. You know, that's entirely unprecedented.
It's the best of all the movies too. You know, I mean, we all have our heart into like the other movies because of the comic books, if you're a comic book fan. But, you know, the other movies were really good to barely okay. I think a lot of people would argue both ways. Like Iron Man, first Iron Man was really good, but it's a little X-Men-y. Like the first X-Men, you could tell they didn't have a lot of money, but it was still decent.
Right.
You know, solid flick. Mm-hmm. This Iron Man 2, I considered something that should just be forgotten.
Yeah, it was sort of a non-entity, really. I was disappointed by it. I mean, it was okay. It was watchable. It wasn't horrifically bad, but it wasn't up to the greatness of the first one. And I was really hoping that with the added money and with the added marketing and all that, they would be able to pull it off, but apparently not.
But it wasn't a Fantastic Four or... You know,
right.
Elektra.
Can you believe they're doing Ghost Rider again?
What's that? They did a Ghost Rider movie?
Yes, they did. And it starred Nicolas Cage of all things. Yeah, I was sick that day.
Yeah, I was sick both days.
Yeah.
I mean, Iron Man 2 suffered from the we don't have a script, so let's let Robert Downey Jr. go crazy. And Robert Downey Jr. is an actor who you have to reel in a little bit or he can get carried away. It felt very like narcissistic and snarky and like he's how much cooler can he get? Okay, already I get it. It was, you know, it came out in just the right spots for Iron Man and it came out in just the right spots for the Avengers too, I thought. It's great. He was great. Everyone was great in the movie.
Yeah, I agreed.
I thought that the individual characters had depth. I thought as a team, they also worked well. I also thought that the Hulk was really quite amazing in this. The first two Hulk films, I wasn't too keen on them, but I thought his character kind of came out in this film.
I mean, what they did differently was in the other two movies, he was 98% beast. In this movie, he was like 85% beast. And there was a bit of Bruce Banner in the Hulk. You know, he could understand, he could control himself. So it became more like the comic book.
Right.
That we know, because I mean, I don't know that many people that really liked the whole comic book when he was just destroying everything. They liked it, you know. They liked Peter David when he was actually intelligent, or the Gray Hulk, or they like when, you know, when he can actually interact with the characters. You know, it's rare when they ever have him talk. And they finally just said, let's just do it. And they did. And he was one of the best things in the film.
Yeah. And I thought the CG turned out really well. We're finally getting at that stage where the physics is starting to look a lot better than it has in the past. That was always the big problem that I had, which was these 3D creations didn't seem to have the same physics as that of the real world. So it always looked a little bit off for me.
Yeah, I thought Cap, a few times Cap jumped and you could tell he turned into an a CG Cap. I agree, though. You know, I think it's the best they've done so far with melding the two together. You know, Iron Man's always easy because it's always easy to do CG metal, you know?
Right, so right.
He always looks phenomenal.
And he has rockets. He's not like jumping, you know, in a way that a human cannot actually jump. Yeah,
exactly. So he's flying around more like a ship, you know, which is probably easier to do. I thought Hawkeye could have used more. I don't think they used him quite enough.
I just felt bad for Hawkeye.
Yeah, I mean, he was bad for half the movie. There's your first spoiler.
But the other thing I thought was kind of interesting is I was a huge Hawkeye fan in the comics. One of the major deals with Hawkeye is that he's deaf. And they made no reference to that whatsoever.
Yeah, clearly he's not.
Yeah.
but I will say, though, because it's always fun to even though you went to I went to this movie, I'm going to go again this week. But let's talk about the things we didn't like, because that's what we love to do as humans.
Oh, sure.
I thought that my issue with Hawkeye being gone, Hawkeye was when I remember him, he was the Wolverine of the Avengers. He was always the guy that would go up against Cap and say, no, we should do it this way. What are you doing? He was always the rebel. Mm-hmm. He was always the guy had a hothead.
Well, it was always the mask as well. It was the very Wolverine-like mask that he wore as well.
That's true. And you know, I thought you lost a little thing. Like, I find it interesting, like, they determined Cap has to have a helmet, has to have a mask, and they did it. But
it looked like Play-Doh.
That's one thing I was talking about with my friend yesterday. I think they could have spent a little more time on Captain America's outfit.
Yeah.
You know, add a little more of the Ultimate Universe to it. You know, a little bit more of the Kevlar type look, and you know, I think it would have been cool if sometimes Cap or like Jim Lee used to draw the X-Men where they wear a jacket. You know?
Right. Like, yeah, that cool field jacket. Sure.
Yeah, field jacket maybe. I mean, I love when he picked up the machine gun and started firing with it, and I love that because that's, you know, just Joss Whedon saying, you know, this guy was in World War II only a few weeks earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, and there's that one iconic cover of Ultimate Captain America where he's sitting there holding a machine gun, you know, with his foot up on the rock. Speaking of that point with Joss Whedon, it was clear to me from this movie that he really, really loves these characters. I think that really came through in the writing of this thing.
They all got a really good amount of time. Obviously, not everyone got the same amount of time, but the time that they had, there was a lot of care, there was a lot of depth to that, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah, it was definitely, you know, there was a lot of love there, and he brought, listen, Josh brought his A-game. I'm, you know, when it comes to Buffy to me is like the Holy Trinity. Buffy, Star Wars, and the Planet of the Apes were, like, those three things mean so much to me, but I was never always a blind Joss Whedon follower. I wasn't a Serenity fan. That
blasphemy.
Yeah.
I didn't watch Buffy when it first came out. I watched it when FX was having this crazy marathon where it was showing four episodes in order per day on every weekday. So I saw the entire series in like a couple months, right?
That's great.
It was fantastic, but I got completely sucked into it. I mean, it was crazy. But yeah, I wound up having a deep appreciation for it. It was really, really well done. I loved the dialogue. You know, the actors, you saw them grow up as well. So you saw them actually get better over time, which is also cool.
And there was a lot of people involved in it. It wasn't just Josh, you know. I would have to say that he didn't always direct the best episodes. It was a magical show. It really was. And if you watch that first season again, they didn't have any money on that first season. It was pretty amazing. But, you know, like I said, he also has a tendency to write some really, like, this is the dialogue a 15-year-old boy, a geek boy, really wishes a girl would say, you know. And it got, sometimes it would get so cutesy with Willow, I would have to be like, oh, man, you know. So I was a little worried about that with the Avengers. I can say from being, you know, someone who's a little more critical, that didn't happen in this film.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Great comedic moments that were fit right into the plot, right into the story. The Hulk did great things. Captain America saying Hulk smash was spectacular.
Oh, that was brilliant. Everyone in the cinema died. That was absolutely hilarious.
you know, actually something you and I kind of went back and forth on was the whole Tony Stark thing. You were saying that Tony Stark was kind of not in character to you, but it turns out it was pulled out of context in the trailer. You know, he was basically parroting back what someone had said about him. He wasn't saying it about himself. So that really worked out, the part where he was saying about, you know, not playing well with others.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. But I mean, listen, it's a fun, it's a blast. It's the most, you know, to me, Dark Knight is still the greatest comic book movie of all time, but it's barely a comic book movie. I mean, to me, that's a drama. That's a crime drama.
Yeah.
One of the great.
The guy just happens to be wearing a suit.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great films of all time to me. As pure comic book movie, Avengers is the best that's ever come out. I mean, seeing those characters jump around, I sat there staring at the screen like a kid again, you know, reading comic books on a Friday afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
The audience that we were at, I mean, they were yelling and clapping. It was great.
It was so much fun.
It was great. I have a big pet peeve, though.
Oh.
Ken Bell?
A pet peeve?
A third or fourth spoiler here for people that watch it. Why, oh, why do they always have to make it so that there's a mothership? And when you destroy the mothership, everything else falls down, including the warriors in this. I mean, in what world has that ever happened in real life? I mean, could you imagine if the U.S. military had one ship, and if you blew up the one ship, every Marine and Army guy fell down on the battlefield and everything stopped working?
Well, they clearly talked to George Lucas about this.
Yes. I mean, but listen, Star Wars, Avengers. I mean, all they had to simply do is they stopped the flow. So now mop up. So just spend 3 minutes mopping up the last guys, you know, beating them up. But they had to do that again.
I don't think they actually could have done it. And maybe that's why they chose that route, because the number of Chitauri coming through and the giant drone ships and everything, these little six little people they're very strong and they're very powerful, but I don't think they could have cleaned up if
but they had a Hulk.
But they stopped them from coming down, so there was no more influx, and they have a Hulk.
But there was already hundreds of them there.
That can be changed in the story in 3 seconds, you know.
Well, agreed. The fact that they didn't go that route, though. Yeah.
I was also a little bit peeved about that, too, because it was like, okay, they just found the off switch, right? And why on earth would there not be the backup control on, you know, the daughter ship?
Yeah, I mean, and they had an off switch. It was closing that, you know, that convenient wormhole or whatever, you know. They did that.
The other thing I got was like, okay, so you launch the nuke and you pilot it through and it hits the mothership. This ship is capable of interdimensional travel. Do you think it can survive a nuke?
Probably. And, you know, it's funny, you know, I also loved your spoiler 5. It's good to see that, like, Josh still has his head in this kind of stuff. Like, these things you see in movies all the times that you hate, like the bad guy that's constantly telling everyone his story, you know? And then in this movie, of course, the bad guy tries to tell the Hulk a story and it doesn't work out too good for him.
No.
It was a great scene.
It was just like, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, that was brilliant. And the expression on Loki's face was phenomenal. Well, he was just like, what the fuck just happened to me?
It's just great. He's a great actor. And God, they had someone solid as Loki. Probably the best thing about Warhorse was Tom Hiddleston, his section.
And another brilliant piece of Whedon writing was the scene with Black Widow talking to Loki, and he's hammering her with all this personal information, and he's hurting her. And huge spoiler, serious, stop listening now. Turns out she's pumping him for information, you know. Although it turns out it does affect her later on. Her whole shtick was she was pumping him for information, and she changes instantly. And
straight out of Buffy, right there.
And straight out of Black Widow, too.
Right, exactly. It was a very, very Black Widow thing. And my God, Scarlett Johansson was awesome. Mostly because she had to fill out the cat suit.
Well, she was also awesome.
Well, you know, it was nice to actually see, you know, you look at this movie, and then you see everything that went wrong with Iron Man 2, you know, and you actually see. Now, I remember Favreau being really angry that they weren't giving him 3 years on Iron Man 2.
Right.
You know, so I you may not be able to blame him for everything.
Well, also a lot of it was test audience driven as well. That period where he's DJing in the Iron Man suit.
Oh, my God.
That was straight up due to the test audience. Pandering. They said it needs to be lighter. And so someone suggested that and they put it in.
Oh, that was so embarrassing. I was embarrassed for the entire film. But, you know, if you look at it now, You hope that, because, you know, everyone knows that Marvel can be cheap and Marvel gets their way. So if they really sit back right now, they should look and they say our two best films, Iron Man and Avengers, were writer director. Right. They came in. They put everything into it. Favreau put everything into that first Iron Man, and Josh Whedon did with Avengers. After this weekend, Shane Black, pressure on him has quadrupled for Iron Man 3 to do a good job with Iron Man 3. But they may have learned their lesson because he's writing it. I think he's writing it and he's directing it. And I hope, you know, I hope he gets a little more serious. And it's funny to say serious because Avengers wasn't just, it was, I mean, people died. It was serious, but it always was fun too.
But it's also a comic book, right? So, you know, how serious can it be? It's not Gone with the Wind. It's not Showa, you know.
Oh, but, you know, most times when you go a little, I mean, you know, I mean, everything has gone darker and, you know, not always for the best. But, you know, like Batman and everything, it certainly worked. But, I mean, and you have to kind of, you know, the next Avengers should probably be a little bit darker. It always, it seems to be the natural progression to get a little darker with each film. But listen, spoiler number 20, Thanos. Thanos.
Yeah, totally out of nowhere. I mean, did you expect that at all?
No, but I have to say that if you don't know, that was Alex Denisoff is his name. He was Wesley, I think, in Angel.
Oh, interesting. Huh. I never liked Angel, so I never watched the show.
I should look that up. I think that's who it is, though. He had him come up, and it wasn't actually just CG, which is kind of cool, and had him do that. But that's exciting. Now, the real question is, though, is that Avengers 2?
Oh,
no. It's Iron Man 3. I've already heard this. I heard the spoiler beforehand. Okay, so spoiler 20. Where are we at? 22?
28,000, yes. Infinity plus one.
Thanos is the Iron Man 3.
Villain.
Boy, because I find that hard to believe. I think he's going to be Thor 2.
There's a Thor 2?
Of course there is.
I didn't think it, to be perfectly frank, I didn't think it was strong enough to bother with.
This just showed that you could have a bunch of people in spandex jumping around and make a great film. But just don't make it so that every Iron Man movie is another guy in armor.
Right.
Yeah, I hate that. One of the people's complaints about the DC versus Marvel thing is that it's like Iron Man against Ironmonger, Hulk against a bigger Hulk, you know.
Bigger Hulk.
Marvel tends to do that a lot. So I hope they will stay away from it in the movies because it's a bit leaden. It's been done.
Yeah.
I mean, they had 100 million of those things in Iron Man, in other Iron Mans, you know, chasing them around and everything. I'm kind of good with that. So hopefully we will get something. But listen, this is what Marvel has to do tomorrow morning. They need to bring Joss Whedon in to the office. They need to hand him a check for $10 million. just like they did to James Cameron for Titanic. They need to hand him a nice little check and they need to say, this is just for doing such a good job. You can walk out with this check and be done.
And pat his ass while he walks out.
Sure. Whatever he wants to do, whatever he's into. And then they need to say, we want you to oversee all the films.
Yeah, yep, yep. We want you to Christopher Nolan this shit.
Yeah, executive produce all of them. Listen, another criticism I had about the film, Joss is still not cinematic enough. I'd be okay with a more cinematic director for the next one, but Joss writing it and producing it and having a really strong hand in it as a writer-producer, like a TV type of writer-producer where they're in charge. He clearly gets it. I bet you he could sit down in 2 weeks and come up with plot lines for all the movies for the next 10 years and let him just caress everything and make it all fit. I can't wait for a new Hulk movie now. I hope they're going to do one.
I know. I've never cared about the Hulk.
I'm actually really excited about the Hulk. Although the only movie that the Avengers really allows to happen now is a Damage Incorporated film.
Oh, yeah. Gimme.
How cool would that be? The amount of New York that gets fucked up.
One of the things that has always bothered me in films, that always take me out of films, is watching the amount of destruction that's happening and watching the careless attitude of the good guys in films. A few weeks ago, I'm still alive after this, I watched Fast Five and then Transformers 3 because they were both on like Showtime.
Were you like in a hospital in one of those things where you can't move and the TV was on?
Not pay for them. They were on Showtime or HBO. But yeah, at the end of Fast Five, two cars are dragging a 100,000-pound safe that's the size of a tiny house. and they're dragging it through the streets of Miami, I think, or was it down in South America? I think it was down in South America, Rio. And as they drag it, it slides through cars, through corners of buildings that people are working in it. When they got done, clearly 300 people should have been dead. So that kind of stuff, like I hate when someone aims a gun. They did it in Mission Impossible. When someone aims a gun from 300 feet away and the person that they're shooting is a foot away from the good guy, you know, and like that shot, I mean, you're going to kill your own guy. You know, it's just we're shooting into crowds, you know, and stuff like that. And in Avengers, what would you say? 200,000 dead?
At least. Buildings should have fallen down. Major support structures were you know,
one
kicked
building
out.
Did fall.
That's true. But with New York, though, you know, the buildings are so on top of each other that if one building falls like that, all the buildings around them are going to fall.
Right. There's a Chitauri, one of the organic ships lying on top of a building. How long before that caves in, you know?
When the Hulk ran through the building and right out the window, man, was that spectacular?
That was so
cool. That was very, very cool.
That was so
cool.
Because
you didn't expect it.
I also really liked the way Hawkeye had his quiver. In the comic book, they never really go into it too much. And actually, there was a comic book series, I think it was called The Marvel Universe, of all things, where it was basically an encyclopedia of the Marvel characters and their weapons.
I think it's the guidebook, right?
Is it the Encyclopedia of the Marvel Universe?
Well, there may have been that as well. This is in the 1980s, I think, when it was actually just a series of comic books, special edition. It was like 24 volumes, you know, one a month like they normally do. And it was...
Oh, the handbook.
Maybe, yeah.
I love that. That was great.
That was so cool.
And they had to finally decide who was stronger. And I think they decided that Thor was a little stronger than the Hulk.
Oh, because, interesting.
Because he's a god, you know?
Right. The Hawkeye thing was really cool because his quiver was controlled via his bow. So the tips of the arrows were interchangeable and they weren't actually affixed to the shaft of the arrow until he hit the go button and decided that the next arrow he needed was a particular type, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
Now, I would say, though, that they need to figure out another way for him to open his bow, because the fact that it bounced around seemed like a mistake. Like when he opened the bow and it went bang.
Right.
It should just be click. When it opened up, the two pieces shook, you know, like they didn't just go click. Like in any other movie, you'd see click.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. Got you.
You know, so it seemed a little, shall I say, limp.
Right. Maybe. But yeah, it did seem sort of anticlimactic. Here are these like gigantic heroes and they're suiting up and everything's groovy and they're getting into their thing. And then you see him twitch his left arm a bit and the bow unleashes. And it just seemed
wobbly.
It was a bit of a letdown, you know.
But I will say this, I'd love to see a Black Widow Hawkeye film. I don't think we're going to get it.
Yes.
Maybe with $200 million, maybe they'll do it. I'd love to see it. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting because now with Thanos at the end, and now I always remember, like, I'm sitting in Avengers and I'm sitting there thinking about when everyone was angry that Bryan Singer was putting the whole X-Men team in black leather. He's like, oh, the regular outfits look stupid. And now you want to sit him down with this movie and go, all right, they could have used a little work on Cap, but everything else looked fantastic, dude. So what's your excuse? Make it a comic book film, you know, make it show their outfits.
Yeah.
Right. If Wolverine looks ridiculous, then fix it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, granted, they got the greatest guy ever to play Wolverine, so that's, you know.
They found Wolverine.
I was going to say, simply because Glenn Danzig probably can't act, because Glenn Danzig is...
In the 80s, they would have got it, but... Oh, you know,
maybe not now, but my gods, yeah.
Should see a bunch of them, but they should bring back... They need to bring in a little color. Can we please... We need an African American, or maybe just an African like Black Panther on the team next time.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. He was a serious favorite of mine.
Yeah. And then they need to bring another female on. It's awful male. So
Well, we could get White Witch, or we could get
Scarlet Witch. But the Scarlet Witch is owned by Fox, as far as I know.
Really?
She's Magneto's kid, right? So.
Oh right. Okay. Yeah.
And Quicksilver, so we may not see them. Yeah, it's weird because, you know, when I grew up, I wasn't into the old X-Men. I was into the, you know, the Chris Claremont X-Men.
Oh, so right. Okay.
To me, the Beast was an Avenger, a blue guy on the Avengers.
You know what I mean? See, that's, for me, I remember the Beast being a Defender. Good God. I think I was going to say, I think I'm the only one in the universe that remembers the Defenders.
With Valkyrie? Come on.
Yeah. How crazy is that? And Gargoyle?
And Namor.
Yeah, Namor was a Defender. Yeah.
I want Namor to be the villain of the next Avengers movie.
Ooh. You know when I say something and it's going to sound totally crazy, so I'm going to say it really fast. I would like to see an Aquaman movie.
You know what? They could totally do a really great job with that if they went all in. Like,
yeah,
if they,
that's the thing. It would have to be all in.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to take it seriously. But wasn't that shot in the beginning of Iron Man underwater spectacular?
That was great.
Oh, my God. Brilliant.
Yeah, it was just like, I just was like, wow. Does he look?
And it set a sort of tone. It's like, and Joss Whedon is really good at this. It set a tone that Tony Stark is doing things and he's being helpful.
There's depth to his character. He's not just a millionaire playboy.
Right. So that when it comes time for him to be on the team, it's not like in the back of your head, there's this little seed growing that says Tony Stark is a sort of a team player.
When he wants to be. You know, you just have to convince him. He's not going to be a part of the team just because someone said, you should totally be part of a team. He's not really a joiner, but he understands the greater good. And he realizes that in order to get the greater good, he's got to team up.
And the stuff between him and Mark Ruffalo in the lab, I thought was really good. I really enjoyed the back and forth between them.
That was brilliant. And again, it's Whedon dialogue all day long, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of miss that Jarvis is a computer. And I love to see Jarvis as a real butler.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But listen, if you noticed at the end of the film, Bruce Banner goes with Tony Stark. So maybe we'll see him in the next Iron Man movie. I wish that Marvel would just take the $200 million and split it in half and give $100 million to Fox and say, give us the X-Men back.
Oh, yeah.
And then $100 million to Sony and say, give us Spider-Man back. I mean, didn't you want to see Spider-Man show up in that battle?
Oh, how could... Yeah, because he lives in New York.
Listen, the new trailer for Spider-Man, it looks pretty darn good.
I was going to say, you know, I originally thought that, oh, really? You're rebooting Spider-Man? Do I really want to see this? What the fuck is this about? And then I saw the trailer and I was like, holy crap, this is going to be really good. You know, they're finally doing it right. You know, they got a really skinny, lanky guy to play Spider-Man and they've realized that he's a scientist, he's an engineer and he's engineering the web slingers and all that. It seems to me that it's more toward the original book, which is fantastic.
And it's cracking and stuff. So
he seems more of that Buscema era
right.
Spider-Man that everyone, you know, that
everyone
was
loves
the Spider-Man right. for many people.
There is a reason that they didn't do too much wisecracking in the other movies, and you could kind of tell when you watch the trailer. A character talking where you can't see their mouth is a little strange on film. So
right.
It looks like they said, too bad. I mean, that's Spider-Man. That's the Spider-Man the guy grew up on. Right. I just think they could have waited another. I would have liked more of another 2 years before I saw another Spider-Man movie. So there was actually people that wanted it. Mm-hmm. But I think they had to do it because they would lose it. So they had to get moving right away or they would lose Spider-Man.
Gotcha.
I was also thinking that because the Avengers, obviously they didn't realize this at the time, but the Avengers is clearly breaking crazy records all over the place. And... You know, Spider-Man's coming out, what, late May, I think? Something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
And so, you know, it's still going to ride the buzz of the Avengers because everyone who saw the Avengers saw that Spider-Man trailer.
Oh, yeah.
And wow. you know?
Yep. And don't count out The Dark Knight.
No, I'm so not counting out The Dark Knight.
Times in July, we've forgotten all about the movies that came out in May.
Oh,
We probably won't this time, but you know, there's still plenty of time to make money. It's a longer movie, but as far as I know, Avengers was only in like 2,500 screens because of the 3D and the IMAX thing.
Matalo, matalo, bang, bang, matalo, matalo, bang, bang.
We'll see. Now, do you guys know and did you stay for the second sequence? There's two.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know about the second one, so we left.
Someone tipped me off before I went in, and so I knew. But I also stay until the bitter end anyway, so I would have seen it. But yeah, I was tipped off prior to.
So tell us about it, because I heard what it is, but tell us about it. This is the last spoiler.
Right, okay. So I'm about to spoil the shit out of everything, right? So the first post-roll scene, we have the introduction of Thanos, right? And then we go through the entire credit sequence. We pretty much have the copyright information. And then we get to this next post-roll scene, which is, of course, tying up the loose end, they're at the shawarma place.
Okay.
All you see is them at, you know, it's not a fancy shawarma place. It's a hole in the wall where people get lunch and they're just eating. There's no dialogue. There's no nothing. They're all just eating their shawarma.
And are they in costume?
Yes, they are.
Oh, that's straight out of Marvel Comics.
It is hilarious. There's no dialogue whatsoever. As a matter of fact, you can kind of see Cap desperately trying to keep a straight face.
Also, he has a movie coming up where he actually has a beard. So they had to put an appliance on his chin.
Really?
So he's trying to cover his face for a lot of it.
Oh, that's bizarre. He can't grow a beard in like a couple of weeks?
No, he had a beard when they reached... This scene was shot after production ended.
This shot was like a month ago they shot it.
Really? Right. Oh, that's funny.
After the Hollywood premiere, they went and shot this the next day. And actually, Robert Downey Jr. came out and said, yeah, we're shooting something tomorrow. And then the producer, I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, and Wayne's like, shh, shh, shh.
Oh, that's funny as hell. Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. But yeah, it wrapped everything up. Oh, it was so adorable. The one last thing, though, was that I never followed the Iron Man comic. I followed him as a player in other group comics like the Avengers, etc. When did Stark and Pepper Potts have a romantic relationship? There was always a sexual tension, but it was always not there. And that was sort of the fun bit for me, that it wasn't really consummated, as it were.
80s, 90s Iron Man.
It's dangerous too in the movie, because you know when that, you know, it's like the old moonlighting thing. If you base your whole television show on the fact that these two people aren't together, then when they finally get together, it ruins the show.
Right.
If it's not about that, then they could get together and there's no problem. But if that's the main gist of the show, so the fact that they were together, I was kind of like, wait, when did that happen?
Well, they kind of did that with at the end of Iron Man 2. In one, it was the all sexual tension. It was all Maddie Hayes moonlighting tastic. I love the fact that you brought up moonlighting. And there was that. And then in two, there was a little bit more of a, hey, this is going to happen. And I think toward the end of the film, it was all but they were getting together.
Okay. And I'd like to have a little eulogy to Agent Exposition.
Oh.
Mark Craig. Well, that's the last spoiler, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, this is a huge spoiler.
Huge, gigantic spoiler.
Yeah. I loved Coulson and
Whedon!
Coulson. We got a first name, right? Phil.
Yeah,
right?
Phil. Yeah. Agent Phil.
And they built him almost out of nothing. It was great. But the best thing about it is now Cobie Smulders in the next film can actually be Fury's right hand, which is, you know, versus suddenly Coulson is, you know, out of nowhere. So
right.
That's the one good thing about it.
That is true.
Looks good in that outfit too, so.
Oh, Cobie Smulders.
Oh, my goodness.
So much.
That is craziness. Yeah. The other thing is that, I'm sorry, but what is up with, it was Fury and Black Widow using 9mm pistols to hit at things that were clearly over like 150 yards away?
No, those are shield pistols.
Yeah, that to me was a really strange thing. Like, give these guys like Han Solo type pistols that look different than everyone else. Because,
right.
like for instance, the gun that the agent brings out, right?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like why, like I couldn't believe that all these superheroes are standing around New York City. Then she pulls out two little guns and starts shooting. It almost looked ridiculous. You know, give her
an AR-15 for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Give her something on there, you know, give her, but you know, it's okay if it's shield technology and it's not a real gun. Give her something that looks like the Stormtrooper rifle or something in between.
Something a little bit amped up. You know, it can even be that size. It just needs to be a little different.
But for Black Widow fans, you're doing the change, the costume thing. I mean, that's what she does. She carries two, you know, pistols that are like that.
Right.
Did she Didn't she also shoot people with like a stinger or something like that?
Yeah, they changed that in the film a little bit, where her bracelets were meant to shoot poison darts, if I recall correctly, in the comic. And now it was sort of a taser type of thing, which she only used very, very briefly. I was like, damn it, I wanted to see like her electrify the hell out of things, but we didn't see nearly enough of that.
Yeah, but the thing where, you know, where Fury goes out and he shoots at the jet with the whatever that was, you know, it's like, all right, yeah, that makes sense. And then, like you say, he pulls out a pistol and he's almost going to shoot it.
It's like, really? Come on.
Fury shot down an American soldier right there. That was bold.
Well, no, if you take a look at it, he basically clips it and it's entirely, you don't see the pilot die.
No.
Well, it doesn't actually go off the carrier.
Right, exactly.
No. Yeah.
So, yeah, it basically just
to be
clipped
frank,
it.
Cap kills a lot of people.
Yes, he does.
Well, listen, let's give Josh Whedon a final thank you. How about the ejecting guy that the Hulk grabs? The ejecting.
Oh, that was brilliant.
Oh, my God. And everyone in the theater went,
yep.
You have to love comic books to do that. That no, a regular person on the film just would never think of that.
And that's one of the things that I think a lot of people forgot about the Hulk is that, yes, he's huge. He's gigantic. He's super crazy strong. But he's also fast. Really, really fucking fast.
Right. He's superhuman, literally.
Let's get a Hulk movie, man. I want a Hulk movie.
I know. Crazy.
Joss, give us a Hulk film.
Yeah,
smash it, make it good.
Yeah, now you know now that they're okay, they could bring in so many cool superheroes and have them just come in and come out, you know. And I'm excited for what's going to happen. I hope I hope some of the Avengers show up in the other movies. I hope we get more Hawkeye so we could learn a little bit more about him.
I'd love to see Ant-Man and Wasp, and Wasp was supposed to be in this film.
That'd be really great.
Yeah, Wasp was supposed
Iron
to be in Avengers.
Do Giant Man? That's the question.
That's a good question. Well, theoretically you could do both. You could have him have like the Ant-Man helmet and then be Giant Man.
Well, you know, Joss Whedon said everybody but Wonder Man. And I'm like, no. Damn it. Am I the only person who likes Wonder Man?
I liked Wonder Man. But I got into Wonder Man.
The 90s Wonder Man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. It was after he was sort of, I guess they resurrected him or something.
Right.
Wonder Man.
It was fun and it was funny.
And I was also more of a fan of the West Coast Avengers than I was of the Avengers. What I really want to see is a kick-ass Doc Strange film.
Really?
It would be nice. We'll see if it...
Am I the only one?
Maybe.
It might be, but listen, if they do what they're doing now with Mephisto and everything, it could be really cool. I just don't go in that Ghost Rider world, you know?
Right.
You know, it's a shame, too, because, I mean, you look at the shots of the Ghost Rider on his bike, and they nailed it.
It looks great. Really hot. Yeah.
And
we saw that on the second one. We saw that first teaser trailer, and you're like, wow, this might actually be good.
Wrong.
And then you saw the other trailer, and you're like, oh, this is gonna suck just as bad as the first
one. Well, that's the other thing, too, because Doc Strange is a difficult character
put
in the film because A, he's super complex, B, what version of Doc Strange do you film? Do you film him when he's Sorcerer Supreme and has unlimited knowledge and power? Or do you have him after, I guess it's the current one, where he's decidedly depowered and basically a shadow of what he was at one point in time?
I want the guy that flies around with the big cape.
Oh, yeah.
But the great thing about it is they're now in New York City. Maybe we'll see an Avengers mansion in the next movie. Maybe they can go see him because they need to talk to the dead or something because Thanos is about death, right?
That's right, yeah.
Maybe they could go talk to him and he's just in the movie for 10 minutes. But how great would that be?
Yeah, just as a cameo.
That would be pretty cool.
That would be pretty amazing. Yeah. And the butler and all that. Oh, that'd be fantastic.
Maybe Guy Pearce says him or something.
You know, they actually do that in the books all the time. They'll like have some weird plot point. Oh, let's go, you know, go talk to him.
Yeah.
Because he's right down the block.
I have to make an admission. I don't read a single Marvel book.
Yeah, but that's tough to, you know, Doctor Strange was always a tough comic book to write. So he was always this great character that showed up in other people's books, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a strong supporting character.
But we're also here to talk about your show.
The Dog Avengers.
Yes. Bat Dog.
I want a dire wolf now. I want a dire, a giant dire wolf. That's what
oh
I want.
God. Oh, you don't have one?
No.
Oh.
No, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You should totally get one.
That's what everyone has this season.
They clearly got enough budget because they're now super CGI enhanced.
They made them bigger and they're using wolves this year. Last year they were using mostly dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a law that you can't use wild animals for production in England.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I think there was, so they went with dogs. I forget what kind of dogs at first. Clearly you could tell they were. Now they look like wolves. But just bigger. The idea of having a companion that sits there and always has your back is something that we all have deep inside of us. It goes back to Chewbacca, really, you know? Han Solo had his faithful co-pilot.
Right. Aren't
you the same Ken Bell that was talking about everybody still talking about Star Wars?
Well, I love Chewie. Come on. How can you love Chewbacca?
And that was why Chewie didn't get a medal, because there was that whole idea of, like, you know, sure, he's a co-pilot of the Millennium Falcon, mm-hmm. and he kill people with the best of them, but ultimately, according to how it was originally planned, he was Han's pet, effectively. Yes.
Yeah, you know, and that's funny because, you know, Lucas, I mean, that's all Lucas, right? You know, also, you know, supposedly the children movie Phantom Menace, they're all slaves.
Right.
You know, it's you know, this is a world of slaves. And a world where Chewie didn't get a medal. And after all the things he did, he couldn't have put a medal around Chewie. I mean,
yeah,
me off to this day.
Speciesist.
Yes. Totally. And you look at Chewie and you go, that's wow. There you go. That's a dog, man. It's a primal thing we have. Anthropologists say that we probably wouldn't have made it where we are now without pact we made with wolves and how we came up with dogs. Without dogs, we might not be existing today. So I always consider that probably the best pact humans have ever made. I have the show called The Dog Files, and I go out and I do episodes all around the country celebrating our love of dogs. This latest episode that's out right now, we went to Fort Meade in Maryland. And I spent 4 days, actually it was spread out. We went for 2 days, then I went back for a day, and then I went back for a day. So I spent 4 days with the dog handlers, with the military working dogs, which was pretty incredible for someone like me because, you know, I go into an army base and I drive up and then I see a tank on the side of the road and I just stop, get out and stare at it for 5 minutes.
Well, you don't see them every day.
Yes. And then, I get back in my truck and drive on. That stuff's still, you know, looking up at a Black Hawk helicopter going by like it's nothing. And I'm like, oh my God, one of the best things that happened to me as a total geek, as a guy who in the 70s would listen to Saturday afternoon movies and take a tape recorder and tape the bullet sounds from the World War II movies so I could use it when I was playing with my action figures with my friend up the street.
Wow.
And we would push the tape recorder and we'd have guns going off. Maybe I shouldn't say it. I had a certain movie about bomb detecting army guys that was a big and won the Oscar 2 years ago. And I had it on my laptop and none of the guys there saw it. So I sat down with about 7 sergeants and corporals and they sat around me and we watched the entire movie where they told me what is real and what would never happen in Iraq. And I said, you know what? I've made it, man. I'm sitting around with a bunch of guys that were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan and they're actually going through a film and breaking it apart. They were pretty good. They said it looked a darn lot like Iraq. They said, but even messier, more wires everywhere. So yeah, it was fun. We met a lot of dogs, a lot of incredible dogs. Right now they use German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois and Labs. Labs are just for bomb detecting. Labs are too friendly to have to use as an attack dog. Labs would just run up to you and lick your face.
Which would be hilarious.
For attack dogs, they're actually dual. They're bomb detection and they're attack. They use German Shepherds and Belgian Malinois. Belgian Malinois are a smaller German Shepherd, shorter hair, and a little crazier and lighter. German Shepherds, right before they bite, they slow down. Belgian Malinois keep going like a missile right into you. Yeah, and even if you watch the episode, you'll see that the smaller, shorter-haired dogs, they just fly into them, whereas the German Shepherd is... The German Shepherd's one of the top three dogs for smarts. Border Collie's number one, then a poodle, and then German Shepherd for the top three smartest dogs. So a German Shepherd takes a step, you know, and stops for a second, you know, and makes sure he thinks, you know, but the Belgian Malinois just goes right into you. It was really incredible. I mean, if you guys saw the episode, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and you can see what, like, exactly like you're saying, when they're showing them, you know, attacking the suit. And the one dog is just like, he's all momentum.
Right.
Yeah, he's just crazy. And they say that they actually have less of a career because they have no qualms about hurting themselves.
Well, it's like a football player, right? You know, here are these guys, you know, hitting full tilt into other big immovable objects.
Yes.
Right. So I can imagine that it's the same thing with a dog. You know, they if they're running full tilt into something that has a significant mass, that's going to shock the system a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, when these dogs, you know, when they know it's time for bite work, boy, you could see it in them. You could see when they walk around in circles, you know, and stuff right before they're going to get going. It was pretty amazing. And it was nice to see the camaraderie. It's nice to see how, you know, because there's a lot of ifs about the army with dogs. You know, in the 70s, we left all our dogs in Vietnam.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's not a really good moment for the army. Now, needless to say, a lot of the leaving of Vietnam was leaving really, really fast on the top of a building with my helicopter. But, you know, they left it. A lot of them, now, they didn't kill them all. I'm sure, being Vietnam, and I'm actually not joking about it, I'm sure some were eaten, right?
Sure.
And a lot of them were given to the South Vietnamese to be, you know, their attack dogs. There's a long history of army dogs. In World War II, the Marines had loads of Dobermans. That was the biggest Marine dog. They called them devil dogs, the Marines. And they also called the dogs devil dogs. Those Dobermans were actually family dogs that people gave up for the cause. And they saved a lot of lives. The Japanese were sneaking up on them constantly. And the minute they got Dobermans, that was over. And a lot of the guys, you know, you're talking about 70 years from now. So there's a different attitude to dogs. You know, they were back then, dogs were kept outside. They were dirty animals a lot more. You know, people liked them, but it wasn't the same thing. And a lot of soldiers were like, keep that dog away from me. And then the minute that they saw that soldier warned everyone when the Japanese were a half a mile away, they all wanted to sleep in the same foxhole as the dogs.
Yeah. And I appreciated that in the very beginning of this year, they kind of like explain the housing situation for the dogs there, and it illustrates the huge change in how they're treated.
Yeah, they're not only air conditioned, but they're also heated. I mean, the Hilton doesn't have that great accommodation.
It's much better now, you know, and they do everything they can to get all the dogs adopted out. A lot of the handlers adopt the dogs later. I just got word from Timothy Roy, who's the guy with Bubba the Lab.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So cute.
Went to Korea for a year.
Oh, right on.
And he just got word when he gets back, he's getting Bubba back. So
you're making me cry again.
A lot of them try and adopt them out. I think things have changed for the better. There's a great story about World War II, the guy that trained all the dogs. When he came back after World War II, they wanted to put down all the Dobermans. And he went in and he said, listen, I'll personally untrain them and get them all back to their owners if you let me. And they said, yes. And he got all but two.
Wow.
Be a great film, by the way. He actually wrote a book about the whole thing about the Dobermans in World War II.
Well, you know, that's a good point. That I think that a lot of people have that mentality that the dogs are some sort of thing you flip switches on and then you send them out and they do it. And it's not a real easy way
to
explain that.
That they're an object. Right.
Yeah, exactly what you just said with like the Michael Vick dogs. A lot of those dogs, they were, you know, those dogs were going to be destroyed. And people, you know, took time and said, you're looking at this the wrong way.
Yeah, they can be retrained and they can be put back into society.
The irony of the Michael Vick situation was because he was rich, he had to pay the court $1 million, and $1 million went to taking care of the dogs.
Yeah.
If he wasn't rich, sadly, I have a feeling the dogs would have been put down.
Oh, easily.
But I think a good thing about that is that news agencies covered that because it was a nice dog story in the end. And then people see that. So hopefully it will change people's ideas about that.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about it is that was 5 years ago, last week, I think it was actually, because I put an article on my site about it. 5 years ago, he was the day to the day when they actually went to his property and found the dogs. Before that, the United States Humane Society would put down fighting dogs. They'd put them all down. So it was a big change. I think that, you know, a lot of the pit people really don't like the Humane Society of the United States because of that.
Right.
I see it a little bit like you said it. They learn that there's loads of groups out there, great groups that are specialized in pit bulls, and will even take ones that can't be retrained and put them in a sanctuary where they can run around on the grass and have a good life for the rest of their lives. And then they'll, you know, they'll take the other ones and they'll work with them till they get better. And so I think HSUS knows knows that now, so they're likely to put down less of them. And I think, you know, that's 5 years ago. That was the attitude only 5 years ago. What was that, 2008?
Well, it's pretty bleak. It's easier to retrain a dog than it is a human, apparently.
Oh, certainly.
It's interesting because a lot of people think like, wow, these dogs, they just turn on a dime and they're just perfect as these tack dogs. They want to play just like all the other dogs. And, you know, when I was first there for the first day, I stayed away from the dogs because they said, you know, these dogs are trained to bite people. But by the last day, I was petting Hilo. I was petting him all day because I had been there 3 or 4 days, and I don't really have, unless a dog growls at me, I have no fear of dogs.
What was interesting to me, I thought, was that some of the dogs were pretty much always on leash, and other dogs were doing off-leash training. So they would be able to hunt down, they would sniff bombs and such off leash, which I thought was an interesting idea, because if your handler is there with you, now you've got two living things in danger, not just one.
Almost all British dogs for the British Army train their dogs to be off leash. It's a specialized dog. And now the United States is doing it with labs where they're teaching them to go down range of 100, 200 yards. One of the things that, my site is, our motto is showing the world that dogs deserve our love, care, and respect. So an episode like this can be a little polarizing because there's a lot of people in the dog community that are like, oh, why are you putting dogs in danger? Why are you doing this to these animals? They don't know what they're doing. The dogs are doing a game of play, barely. If they smell a bomb, they get their toy. I don't want to see any animal die, but they defend it because you see 22-year-olds go home to their wife and their kid that they haven't even seen yet that's 2 years old because of that dog.
We're putting humans on the line as well. And dogs happen to be better at this. And again, we've got that pact with dogs. We have domesticated this animal. And so there's an affinity there. For me, it seems like a natural extension. It doesn't seem to me that it doesn't seem exploitative.
Well, I mean, I have two hounds, okay? I have an American Foxhound Pointer, and I have a Beagle Border Collie. American Foxhound Pointer, that is a dog that wants to hunt. He's gotten two rabbits and a squirrel on his leash. He's caught them. That's how good he is as a hunter.
Wow.
While I was walking him. Like I always said, if he had a little Red Baron plane, he'd have two squirrels and a squirrel on the side. He is a hunter born and bred. Right now, but his life is a life of a lap dog. Some of the happiest dogs are dogs that have a job. And your lap dog that you have wouldn't exist because at first, we didn't have dogs because they were cute and fun. We had them because they kept us alive. We had them because they stayed in the camp and told us when the enemy was a mile down the road. They were an early warning system for people 20,000 years ago. We wouldn't have the lap dogs we have today without the working dogs. And dogs, they want to work. Listen, they love to have something to do. All dogs love to have something to do. Lots of the problems people have with dogs, destroying the house and stuff, is because they have nothing to do. And the smarter the dog, the more destructive they can be. So you're talking about German shepherds, you know, they're sitting there, they think they can figure things out, and you're sitting them and they're sitting there and they're not doing anything. That's why it's kind of cool to have to do stuff with dogs, to do obstacle courses and frisbee and stuff where they can use their mind and they can figure stuff out.
And really be active with a dog as well. Not just, oh, well, I'm going to take you for a walk and it's going to be a 4-block walk. You can do your business and we'll go back. You know, these dogs really do need to work. The shepherds and the border collies and the Australian kelpies and such like that. You know, I've got a lot of experience with a very specific Australian kelpie. She goes off leash in the dog park, and sure enough, she is herding all of the dogs in the dog park.
You know, an interesting little aside about the herding instinct. The herding instinct is simply a hunting instinct that men have placed a hold right before they attack. If you watch an animal stalking another animal to kill it, and then you watch a border collie stalking the sheep, that is just basically their hunting instinct where we said, okay, we want you to do this, but you're going to stop right here.
And that goes back to what you were talking about earlier about the anthropological component of this, is that, like you said, we have advanced with them right alongside us because they needed to eat. We had food. There's a trade-off where, like, well, we'll get a little closer to your camp, and then our trade-off is we'll let you a little bit closer because you say you're early warning, you help us, you can help us hunt, but we have food, you give us something, we give you back. People tend to forget that we are part of nature, too, and that this is a symbiotic relationship just like any other two animals.
And they couldn't live without us. Dogs could not live without us. Well, no, wild wolves certainly can, but what dogs cannot.
It is the only, as far as I know, and if I'm not using the correct terminology, excuse me, it is the only two like species that have formed an alliance. I mean, think about that for a second. Name another animal that's formed an alliance with us.
Yeah.
They've joined up. Obviously, we're probably never going to know the exact beginning, but the latest talk is simply that when we started staying in one place longer, clearly there was a dump. There was a place where we threw stuff, and the wolves or the wild dogs found it and would start eating out of it. Then the humans basically said, "Well, you know, they're kind of warning us when stuff comes by, and they're good for hunting, and wow, they're keeping us warm at night if they sleep with us. They're like a portable heater. All right, that's a good trade-off. You can eat our extras. You can eat our spoiled food and everything, and we'll let you stay here." And, you know, being such a social animal, that's what happened. I mean, if we were aquatic, that would probably have been the dolphin, right?
Sure.
Would have become our friend. Dolphins are a hell of a lot smarter than even dogs. To me, it's a very sacred thing. Almost any human being, like, you can look at and go, well, you know, they did something. I always tell everyone when they call me up and they ask me a question about their dog is doing something wrong, I say, first off, it's your fault. Don't blame your dog. It is a dog.
Right.
Don't forget, it's a dog. It doesn't know any better. It's your fault, and you have to figure out how to get them to not do that anymore. A lot of the times, it's just laziness. When I feed my two dogs, they sit there. I put the food in there. I put water in there. I put their vitamins in their food, and they just sit there. And then I walk away, and then I either just make a sound or I say their names, and one by one, they go and they eat. You know, and I've had people say, oh my God, my dogs are all over me. And I'm like, well, this took 5 minutes a day for 2 weeks, and now they do it. And they're like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, but you have to do it when you get home from work in New York City for 11 hours. You have to put in that 5 or 10 minutes for 2 weeks. And people are just inherently lazy. And so now they have the dogs jumping all over them.
And they don't do it to their children either. And that's a problem because children don't know any better. You know, I never get angry at the children who are running all about, you know, Starbucks or wherever. I get angry at the parents for not parenting.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing with a dog. You know, the dog doesn't know any better. You have to be the alpha, and you have to tell the dog what is acceptable behavior.
Now, picture the idea that about 2.5 to 3 years old is when a child becomes more intelligent than a dog. Okay. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's as far as I remember reading, that's about the age where they are now more intelligent than a dog. So picture not blaming a 4 or 5 year old. So why would you blame a dog?
Right.
With the intelligence of a 1.5 year old.
You know, something if I could jump back to something you mentioned, that, you know, some people call you out saying, oh, why are you putting these dogs in harm's way? Another thing about this show I really enjoyed, at the end, the statistics showing the change between what's gone before and how things are now, and how we may be putting these dogs in harm's way. We've always been doing it, but the differences between now and the people who come home and who don't, and also the dogs that come home now, is so much, it's huge. But another thing about the off-leash training is some people may see that, well, you're putting just the dog in harm's way. Yeah, but it's like, but you think about it, the human is probably an impediment to the dog at that point. You know, because that dog can get out there and sniff for the bomb, and a human is probably going to hold him back and potentially be in harm's way for no reason.
And the dog is probably lighter as well, which probably won't trigger a pressure bomb.
I mean, think about it this way. If the handler's not reading the dog correctly, the dog can only go, you know, depending on the leash, 5 feet or 20 feet off the leash, right? I agree. Having the dog off leash works really well, you know, and that, again, that's with the labs. When people say that to me about, oh, but, you know, they shouldn't be put in harm's way, at the end of the episode, you know, I actually, it's funny because I've dealt with, you know, as a editor and a shooter, I've dealt with lots of corporations. Trying to get information from a corporation, boy, you know, asking them a few questions and no one has the answer and everyone's passing the buck. I emailed the Army. I kid you not. I emailed the Army and I said, hey, I have a dog website. Do you have a listing of all the dogs that were killed in the line of duty? And the guy said, wrote me back like 2 hours later. He says, you know, give me a day. Let me look. And I said, wow.
That's because that's what the Army is designed to do.
I had a list of the dogs that died in the line of duty. And at the end of the video, that's their names that come up on the screen.
That was very cool.
Yeah, that was a really great touch.
I'm talking to you guys. There is a difference between regular folk and dog folk. And I am clearly on the dog folk. Believe me, I am. You can't deal with these animals and the stuff I do without getting really empathetic to their thing. So at the end of the episode, I needed an argument. I needed something that's answered that question of why are they putting dogs in the line of duty? And my answer was simply at the end, I say that in the last 10 years, over 22 dogs were killed in the line of duty. I mean, let's be honest, a bomb blew up. And a lot of those, their handlers died too, a few of them. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just the dog. And I wrote that to be honest, because I want to tell an honest story. I don't want to like go, oh, they're all fluffy and they all come home and everything's fine. There's over 3,000 dogs, 22 died. And then what I write is, by the way, in the last 10 years in America, 40 million were put down in America's shelter system.
Right. That number was shocking.
40 million, 4 million a year. This past year, we knocked it down to 3 million. So it's actually working. And in the 70s, it was 17 million a year. So the dog rescue world has done an incredible thing. And I try and remind people all the time, you know, guys, it was 17 in the 70s. Then it was 4. And this past year, we brought it down to 3. So that's what I said. I mean, really rationalize that out. 22 dogs died that saved hundreds and thousands of young GIs who came home to their families because of these dogs. In our own country, 40 million have been put down. You know, what's the real, where should you really put your ire, you know?
If you're really worried about dogs and you're looking at the military dogs, you're looking in the wrong direction.
Right. Go rescue a dog. That's what I say. Both my dogs are rescued. Go rescue a dog. Did you like the different guys and going through each dog and what they did?
Oh, yeah.
I got to know a little bit of the personality of the handler and the dogs themselves, and kind of what they are capable of doing. I was really, really impressed by it. I also really liked the after show, just because I like the idea of your crew getting bit by military dogs.
On the second day when the crew was with me, the other 2 days, I pretty much just went down there alone the last 2 days. Ted said, Sergeant Perry said, does anyone want to get in a suit? And so we got two of the guys, Khalid, and we got Kevin, two of the guys that were helping out on the shoot, and they got in the suit. And I put that at the end after the credits of them getting attacked. Now, Khalid is part of a production company in New York right now called Variable, who's doing a lot of good work. And also Tyler, who was the Army liaison.
I was going to bring that up.
Tyler, if anyone wants to believe that good things don't happen from Twitter, I met him on Twitter. And Tyler, you know, I'm using horrible terminology because I'm not in the Army, but he was in charge of the combat camera brigade. He was in charge of 200 cameramen. He went to Iraq for a year to film, and he got the whole Army over to the 5D.
Wow. Right.
Because now they could do both. That was his argument, I believe, is that they can actually now shoot video and take pictures, the same person. So we got in contact and he says, well, why don't you do an episode down here in Fort Meade? And I'm like, yeah. And so he got in and he met Khalid, and now he's one of the producers that works with Khalid.
Oh, that's fantastic.
He's out of the Army.
I was dying to ask you if Tyler had something to do with this, because I think a lot of people who, well, a good chunk of the people who listen to our show probably know who Tyler is. It's Tyler, if you don't, it's Tyler Ginter. He was a combat camera operations
officer. At Tyler Ginter. The whole episode wouldn't exist without him. So all around, man, I think it was a lot of fun. I think it's one of our best episodes.
Definitely.
I really enjoyed it a lot.
And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, or with you about. You pretty much wear all of the hats on the Dog Files. That's a lot of work to do in what seems to be a very fast turnaround.
Well, I mean, I shot it quite a while ago, so it's not that fast, because I have so many other things to do other than just editing video episodes. Most of the time, it's me and my assistant. The first 2 days of shooting here, though, I brought a little crew. I brought Kevin and I brought Khalid. We did two cameras, two HVX 200s on this shoot. What a time saver to have two shots on an interview to cut back and forth and have more control over having them say what you'd like them to say and not and be able to cut out the ums and the you knows and stuff like that, which is really cool. So I had more help than normal with this one, but usually a lot of times it's just me and a person that holds a boot. That's okay. I kind of like being able to run and gun and stuff like that. You know, post-production wise, my assistant will come in. He'll take all the footage and he'll make a bunch of sequences in Final Cut Pro. Like, for instance, in this one, he would do, here's Anthony Sergeant Anthony Mull sequence. Here's Sergeant Timothy Roy sequence. Here's, sequence for Arthur Jones and Ted Perry. Here's the dog, the slow-mo dog attack footage. Here's the shooting footage when they're shooting with the dogs. And he'll break it all down, and I trust them. Before him, it was someone else. I trust them to go through the footage and make some decisions on their own. No, under threat of death if they leave. They leave a fantastic shot out that I never see. But listen, I'm a firm believer. You can't. I'm not making a David Fincher film. I cannot look at every shot in every second, or I'll never get done. So I let them, and they'll usually take 3 hours or 4 hours of footage and knock a solid hour out of it, or hour and a half out of it. And then I take all those sequences, sit down, and then I start editing. That's basically how that goes. And it's also nice because when the assistant editor sits down next to me when I'm editing, if I'm looking for a shot, he knows exactly where it is because he went through all this stuff.
Now, do you usually have an outline of a particular show? Oh, I want to dedicate X number of minutes to this segment, X number of minutes to this other segment, or is it much more loose based upon the footage you have?
Me, it's loose. I'm doing something a little different. I'm doing more of a magazine format show. A magazine format show doesn't always have a strong, dramatic through line. It just doesn't. It's about interviews and it's about show and tell. When I can get a nice dramatic through line, I jump on it. On our second day of shooting, Sergeant Anthony Mull said, you know, in a month or two, I'm out of the Army. I've been in the Army. He was one of the guys that joined up after 9/11 to serve his country. He was in there for 8-9 years. He was leaving. As a producer, you have to be ready for that stuff. No one else is there. The minute he said that, I said, I now have my ending. If you notice, the music is different than most of the other episodes. I have lots of hard rock music going with the dogs. They're kick-ass dogs. It's not...
The cuts are different. It had a very different feel.
I want to adapt to that and not go with the same music I use for an Ice Cream Social with dogs. You know, that first episode, it's a completely different thing. Now I know, okay, my ending is going to be him leaving. And from the experience of going out and shooting these all the time, I don't like really write outlines. The one thing that's really great about the Dog Files is I created it as an outlet where I could do something where I was in charge and there was no client telling me what to do, because we all know about clients. So that's what it was for. So to me, it's like I either sink or swim and it's my fault. If the episode sucks, it's my fault. There's no one else to blame. And I love it. I love that feeling. I've gotten to the point now where I know, okay, we need this, we need that, we need to reverse, we need this. I know right away when someone says something that sounds a little weird and I know dog people are going to cringe, I'm going to be like, you know what? Don't say that. I'll direct them with the interview. And I'm always listening. You always hear like the last line when you're shooting. Sometime in the shoot, you hear someone say a line that sounds like they summed up the entire episode. And I just go, that's it. That's the end of my episode. So many times I do know the end before I even start editing because I'm listening. On this latest episode, I finished it like 2 weeks ago and I was down at my parents' house and I played it and, you know, they loved it. You know, typical me, I have this adulation coming from my parents about how great the episode, and I'm sitting there watching it going, I don't like it. I don't like it. There's something wrong. There's something wrong. No, something's wrong. So I get back on Monday and my assistant comes in and he goes, what are you doing? And I says, you're going to kill me, man. I'm going back in to do some editing. There's something missing. And so I went back in and I created that sequence where they talk at the end. The sequence where Ted Perry talks about being in Iraq with his dog and sharing his water with the dog. And that great line by Arthur Jones when he says it's the greatest job in the world.
Yeah.
Some sequences can be like, here's my dog. This is what he does. End of sequence. And it just felt wrong. So I went back in and I found some more lines of dialogue and I changed the lines of dialogue and added in and just changed that around. And when I did those two things, the entire episode shifted. I couldn't believe it. I was like, that's it. I did it. I don't know what it is, but that minute and a half sequence and that 30-second seconds changed the entire episode. But I feel like I got it because, you know, listen, the whole idea of the Dog Files is I want everyone to be in tears at the end, always.
But I'm also a sucker for that type of thing. I love getting emotionally involved and getting that emotional connection as well. And I think you did that really well, not just in the latest edition. I saw the Pit episode and I really liked that as well.
The 9/11 hero dogs.
Oh, yeah.
I bawled.
And here they are. These are dogs. You know, these are the animals that you love and they also have a job to do. And to see them in their element and celebrated like that is really just, it's tremendous.
Thanks. You know, it's interesting about that, the crying aspect, like the 9/11, like all these aspects, it is, you know, you can have people say great things, but it is music choice that does it. It's funny too, because if someone asked, is there a secret? And I'm like, no, I just keep looking through the music until one goes bing and I go, that's it. And then that's the song. And I just know that's the song. Without the music, you wouldn't bring in half the emotion. This past summer, we did a 44-minute version of the Hero Dogs of 9/11 for Animal Planet Canada.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, you were telling me about that
before. Yeah, it was a crazy experience. We basically went in and turned it into a 44-minute episode. We got to interview all these great people. At the end, I talk about Sirius, the dog that died in 9/11. I met all these incredible people. That's probably the most, other than helping the dogs, the most rewarding thing on doing a show like this is these discovery-type, docudrama-type shows. These people bring you into their life. They don't know you. And they open up and they're honest to you. And all they're asking in return is that you not screw them over. So these people just bring you into their lives and they tell you all this stuff and you see everything that's going on. And when you're, and you guys know, if you're looking through a lens, you see stuff that other people don't see. That is the number one thing that I can call all these different people friends now. You know, the guys in Pit Proud, I talk to Rue all the time. The 9/11 people I talk to now. And I think when I interview them, they see it too. I know what questions to ask, you know, because on one point I'm as empathetic as you could get. And the other point, I'm a producer and I know if I get a tear out of their eye, it's going to make a more powerful episode. So you got to balance it. You know what I mean? Because sometimes I can feel guilty as storytellers. Sure. Yeah. We know that you've got to get emotion out of the people. It's all about the storytelling and the emotion. It's number one. I'm not a gigantic tech guy. I don't know a lot of key commands in Final Cut Pro. I'm just doing it off of feeling and trying to get these things across. Please tell me a story. Please get an emotion out of me. Make me cry. Do something interesting. You know, this is the longest episode I've done of the Dog Files. It comes in at like 18 minutes. I think Pit Proud was 11. That was originally the longest. But I didn't think there was a lot of fat on it.
No.
It seemed really tight.
I'm a guy that probably edits too tight sometimes. The only thing I can do is like cut out a dog or two. And I didn't want to do that. You know, I was like, you know what? I think it's interesting. I think it changes up. You go from here's this dog to the equipment that they use to shooting with the dog, to the sicking the dogs on people. You know, I actually, a funny aside, I asked Anthony, I said, do you have a secret word that you tell the dog when you want him to attack? And he leaned in and real quietly said, yeah, get him.
Nice. And,
so I didn't think it dragged, you know, and listen,
it's the bloopers, unsafe think, word.
Yes. So don't go near an attack dog and say, get him. Even the blooper stuff with my crew is 3 minutes. I could have had a 15-minute episode, but I said, you know what? Don't watch the last 3 minutes then if you don't want to see it. You know, you don't have to get the episode.
And it's also fun, or at least for someone like me who really likes the whole engagement aspect. You know, you get to see the crew. These are the people that made this thing, to see them interacting rather than breaking that fourth wall. I love to see that stuff, that behind the scenes type of stuff.
Because to me and you, there are two stories. There's a story that Ken's showing, and then there's a story of Ken, which is why he's on our show.
But what's interesting about it is what I just said, that people let you into their lives. These guys can go on with the rest of their life and say, I was on an army base and I put on a bite suit and was attacked by a German shepherd.
You know? I mean, how many people get to say, yeah, I was able to do that?
You know, I don't know if it's a bucket list. I don't know if it's out of an airplane or something like that, but it sounds like a 100-item bucket list, maybe.
Yeah. I would certainly do it. I mean, because you're in a giant suit, you're not going to get harmed. It's going to be scary because, in general, you don't want to have dogs coming up to you to bite you, but to go through that experience, I imagine that's pretty wild.
You feel it through that bite suit.
Oh, I imagine you do.
said, you still feel that pressure, man. It's close to hurting, but there's no blood. I'm glad they did it, and I'm glad I put it in because, you know, it's something for them too, you know, to see.
No, it was fun to see. I enjoyed it.
The next episode we're working on, last June, I went out and shot a few episodes. We followed a Detroit. There's a big dog problem in Detroit, you know, less and less people living there, but supposedly there's 50,000 stray dogs in Detroit.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so I went out there for a day with this incredible woman, just the coolest. She's tough. She looks like she's out of the army. Butch haircut, tough. She goes out. She's someone that went through hard times as a kid and looked like she put on a big, tough exterior. And then she goes out and saves puppies. We follow her and about 10 of them as they drive around Detroit, and they only go out in like three cars. One of them's a police officer, one of the people, and they go out and they look for dogs in not very nice areas. I got to do my first episode that felt like I was doing an episode of Cops. Lavalier on her, and she saw a pit bull going into someone's backyard. All of a sudden, the car stops. She jumps out of the car and she's running through backyards. You know, like she said, you know, you'll never catch a dog that doesn't want to be caught. You hear her, you know, breathing, all that great Lavalier sound, you know, but you don't always see her. And then her head pops up and you hear people going, they got him this way. So that's going to be the next episode. I'm really excited to do a much more really handheld-y type of episode. So it's going to be a whole different thing.
That sounds really exciting.
Yeah. So that's really cool. All these people brought me in. Everyone's worried, you know, these are nonprofit groups and they don't need to have someone make an episode that makes them look bad. Right. You know what I mean? So they bring you in, they trust you, and you get this really cool experience at the end of the day. We even had a car like trying to run us off the road for like a minute. Like, what are you doing in our neighborhood? You know, like on the brakes and stuff, and all the windows were blacked in. And we were like, wow, this
clearly
is
clearly you're not meant to be there.
No, you're not meant to be there, you know. And then she brought us to some abandoned houses and she showed how you can tell that what they do is they have the dog fighting in one house, but they keep the dogs in another house. It's crazy. Even a cop pulled over and was like, just be safe, guys. You know, but he was cool. I guess that's about it, man.
Yeah, nice.
I need a little shout out. I'm looking for a little help. Maybe someone that listens can help me. I'm looking for someone with a Red Epic, you know, 300 frames a second Red Epic that can give me a day of their life with their camera. Maybe someone on the East Coast. I'm working on a documentary. I'm working on taking the Pit Proud episode and I'm making it into a full-fledged documentary. And I want to go out and film. And basically it's about all the jobs that pit bulls have that you wouldn't expect. I'm going to interview a dog that's actually a police dog and he's a pit bull. And I have a lot of pit bulls that are Frisbee dogs. So I want to film in 300 glorious frames a second pit bulls jumping through the air and catching Frisbees, and the 60 frames a second on my AF100 isn't going to cut it for this. So anyone out there, just Twitter at Ken Bell, 2 N's 2 L's. One day, and I'll do a lot back for you. I promise you. I'll do anything I can do to help you out.
Nice. So thank you very much for being on our show. Really appreciate it. So where can we find you?
Just go to www.thedogfiles.com. You can go at Dogfiles on Twitter or at Ken Bell, KENNBELL, for just me, where I don't talk about dogs as much. And facebook.com/dogfiles. And you can check out the latest episode, which is episode 15, A Few Good Dogs. And that's the military war dogs episode.
Excellent. Thanks again. And Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter as well at TANKGRRL or at about.me/MaggieMcPhee. And where can we find you?
You can find me on the Twitters at Octothorpe, OCTOTHORPE. Of course, you can also find the show at RI4E, and that's the numeral 4. So please subscribe, please follow us. That would be really lovely. And we'll see you all next time. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts, Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out.
I like Kenny, man. You can turn him on and he'll talk.
Oh my God, it's fantastic. I'm loving it.
Is that good? That's good?
Oh yeah.